Welcome to In the Moment. Lori Walsh is back tomorrow, but for today, I'm Keely Boltina here with Kara Hetland. Hey, Kara, do you know what day it is?
It's Wednesday.
Hey, that's a good answer.
Woohoo!
That also means it's our weekly conversation with political commentators from around South Dakota. Welcome to political junkie John Hunter of the Madison Daily Leader. Hi, John.
Thank you. Hi.
And Seth Tupper is enterprise reporter with the Rapid City Journal. Hello, Seth.
Hello, and thanks for having me.
I will try to use real words in this segment. That's my goal.
It's a two-for-one deal today, guys. You ready for us both?
We are ready.
Let's start. It's crossover week in South Dakota. What are the big bills that you're going to keep an eye on?
Well, let
John go first.
Well, Seth, I think's got something there. Go ahead.
Okay, Seth can go first.
No
That's
problem.
Fine.
I was just going to mention one that already has had action this morning was the bill to basically allow science teachers to I don't know how to explain that to teach as their conscience sees fit on certain controversial issues, probably including climate change, evolution, et cetera. Very controversial bill was up in a committee this morning and went down to defeat. I don't have the vote in front of me. I think it was 11-4 or something I saw. So that was one to watch that already has gone down to defeat. And then I think, you know, the big ones that everybody will be watching is all of these various bills to replace parts of initiated Measure 22, which was billed as the anti-corruption measure that was approved by voters back in November but was repealed this session by the legislature. There's bills floating around out there to possibly replace parts of that measure that are more palatable to legislators. And, of course, we'll have to see how many of those actually move on.
Yeah, and if we double back to that bill about teaching in the classrooms, I know it's been a little bit challenging, I'll say, for me as a reporter to fully present what that means because proponents of the measure said it doesn't incorporate something like creationism in the classroom. It just broadens the teaching to include other scientific theories. But so maybe it wasn't the Big Bang, but maybe there are other scientific theories that could contribute to the creation of the universe. But on the floor, then there were discussions about, well, we should have the flat earth theory taught in our schools because then it challenges the facts. And I feel like that it was kind of a little bit of a micro example of this challenge that we're facing all over the place about, well, what is fact and when can we say it's fact and when is that indisputable? Is that...
Am I the only one?
Okay.
No, that's, I think, a very good point. And there is, a gray area between the kind of accepted fact and kind of triple-checked confirmed fact. So it sounds like we're mincing words, but when people talk about climate change, for example, there are facts that go with that, but they aren't normally indisputable facts. So it gets very tricky. And, you know, I think in most cases, we want educators to do the best they can to present as much as they can. Some legislators, of course, believe that science classes are for science and, you know, religion classes or philosophy classes or other things like that was the place to present other things, especially along with creationism kind of lines. But it's one of those debates, I think, that frankly will never get solved, at least in the near term. And so the question is, do you allow teachers to teach what they believe, or should there be some sort of overriding curriculum definition from either the state or the local school board?
You know, I had a science teacher say to me, I have to teach what something is based on science, right? So I have to teach that. And she just had a really hard time getting her head wrapped around this piece of legislation. So really, what's the why behind it? I mean, they're trying this in several different states, aren't they?
Yes. I mean, the why behind it really is that there isn't a universal agreement on what is science or what should be taught in classrooms. And when that doesn't get resolved at the local level, it tends to, at least in South Dakota, tends to rise up to the legislative level, which most observers believe that a lot of educational decisions should be made at the local level, whether it's local school boards, local administrations, or so on. But in controversial areas such as the ones we're talking about here, you also get overarching themes of faith, religion, politics, and then and so all those things, you can't deny that those are all part of our life, and you can't just say that and slice those out of it. So it's very complicated, and I'm not sure, again, we'll get something resolved very quickly here.
Well, and as far as crossover day coming up tomorrow, I know that lawmakers decided not to move forward with a bill last night that adds an additional abortion restriction for certain kinds of abortion. Are there anything else that we need to make sure that we know is either not on the radar for lawmakers or something specific that we should watch as they move forward on the other side? Because at this point, the point of crossover day is you're halfway to the governor's desk with that legislation.
Yeah, I guess I would add, you know, the gun bills, there's the bills to basically make it a bill to make it so that you wouldn't need a concealed carry permit anymore to carry a concealed weapon. That's obviously one to watch.
John Hunter, are you hearing more about that? I mean, what's the groundswell like? I guess I haven't heard a lot from people on that one.
No, I haven't heard much either. So, you know, South Dakota's generally been a kind of a strong gun state, but we're breaking some new ground here that, you know, especially kind of bringing concealed guns into the state capitol building, generally kind of thought off limits, but or into schools. And I mean, there's a lot of challenges here. But no, I don't hear much, at least around Madison, where people are trying to bring this to their legislators. Rather, I think the legislators are bringing it to themselves.
Let's talk a little bit. Kristi Noem spoke yesterday to lawmakers. Any of you catch that?
No, I haven't had a chance to review what she said and just hope to. But obviously it being interesting that we all know that she's announced that she's running for governor in 2018. So that's quite an advantage to be an elected officer already and have to be able to be invited or request to give a speech in front of a full session of the legislature. Obviously makes her look quite gubernatorial and gives a preview of what, you know, she might look like and sound like if she were there giving a state of the state address or a budget address. And that's an advantage, obviously, that if she has a Democratic opponent, you know, won't have that kind of opportunity. So it was for her, it was, you know, whatever she said, it was a great opportunity just for an optic to appear, you know, to give people an image of what could be their future governor.
She supported the president and his policies, and also made it known that she's not a career politician, and she looks forward to coming back to South Dakota. There you go.
Okay, sounds good. Because I didn't catch it either. But I do wonder if John Hunter or Seth Tupper, you could speak to what may be, you know, the bubblings of the primary race for governor. When we talk about Marty Jackley having moved some money with that sort of an intention, in my mind, he's kind of he's the state's attorney general, so he's kind of a law and order candidate. And I know that U.S. Representative Kristi Noem sent a letter to the Attorney General Jeff Sessions saying, hey, let's talk about this violent rising crime. Is that is there something that has come up that would have prompted her to do that? Is this a good opportunity to maybe show that she is also really focused on solving crime and making the place safe? Or am I just making things up in my head? That's always an option.
It's very creative if you are making it up. I'm very impressed.
Thank you.
But I don't think that's a kind of a strategy for her campaign. And yes, Attorney General Jackley is, you know, comes from things from a legal standpoint or from law enforcement and so on. But the letter to the national attorney general. I think it addresses a real problem, frankly. It's going on in across America, and including South Dakota, and maybe more so because of Native American reservations where crime has escalated and so much. So I don't think it's a part of the gubernatorial thing, but it does show, I think, that in backing up a step to her speech, I think, is one of the advantages of being an incumbent anywhere. And Attorney General Jack Lee enjoys that as well. See, he's in a political office. He has press conferences, and he has, you know, those kind of events that a challenger wouldn't have. But and maybe it's good, maybe it isn't, but that is one of the reasons that incumbents tend to do very well in America and get reelected, is because they have that visibility, they have those images, and so on.
I would say I think it is fair that maybe there were political motivations with that, but also genuine motivations to, attack the problem in South Dakota. There has been kind of maybe a mini flood here of stories all over the state, both out here. We had the story recently on a huge uptick in homicides last year on Pine Ridge. Argus Leader did a story recently on just an overall uptick in violent crime in South Dakota. There's been numerous other stories done, so there obviously is something to it. But, you know, I wouldn't be surprised also if there was, you know, some political gain from Christine Ohm positioning herself as trying to attack that problem, because if you're going to blame somebody for a rise in violent crime in South Dakota, who might you blame? Well, you don't have to think ahead too far to think you might blame the top law enforcement officer in the state, and that's Marty Jackley. And so with so many things with politics, maybe there is, maybe there isn't a political motive, but oftentimes there's both. There's a genuine motivation to help people and solve a problem, but it also conveniently has a political aspect to it.
And do you think Kristi Noem's, you know, ongoing support for President Trump and his policies is going to be a good thing for her, or should she distance herself a little bit in South Dakota, the Republican state?
I think it's a very good question. She has been a loyal Republican throughout her term, and when I say that, she has adhered to kind of strict Republican policies. I think there were real challenges for her during the campaign, especially some of the allegations of sexual misconduct by candidate Trump. Nevertheless, she, with just a few exceptions, she has remained loyal to that. And, you know, South Dakota member voted, you know, for Donald Trump in this election. I mean, that's our electoral votes went that direction. So in some ways it would seem to align itself, but it would be hard for any candidate to kind of blindly, do that. I think the best path for her or for anyone would be kind of pick and choose and say, these things that the president does, I'm fully behind, and these things I disagree with. I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah,
so
as we stand here today, obviously it benefits her, as John said. I mean, President Trump won by a healthy margin in the popular vote in South Dakota. But as always with Donald Trump, you're kind of playing with fire. You don't know. He's very unpredictable. You know, could things happen between now and the U.S. House election that would cause the Republicans to turn on Donald Trump? Of course they could. You know, he's wildly unpredictable. So, but she does have the luxury of you know, being able to watch that and see what happens and adjust accordingly.
So take me to the rally on Monday then, Seth, in Rapid City.
Well, we had, you know, it was just kind of a microcosm of our country, I guess, very interesting, you know, people on one side advocating for Donald Trump, a slightly larger group advocating or, you know, criticizing Donald Trump, and very civilized, you know, I mean, both sides very boisterous and animated in their own view, but very also, I guess, respectful of the other side's right to be there. But, you know, obviously they're not going to come to any agreement on their or any compromise on their positions either. So in that way, it was just, you know, if you want to see what shape our country is in now politically, that was it. It's just people in opposite camps and very firmly in those opposite camps. And you know, they're probably going to stay that way. Probably didn't change anybody's minds.
But they were hurt or felt that they were hurt. So I guess on some level that makes us feel as individuals a little bit better, right?
Well, if I can add one thing to that, and that is, I think it's exactly what the founding fathers had envisioned when they set up much of the first papers of the government, in that fact that, that citizens can and should peaceably assemble and ask for redress of the of ills that the government has put upon them, and to for freedom of speech and freedom of the press. I think it's all those things. I think these kind of assemblies where people can speak freely about whether they agree with what their government is doing or not is not enjoyed in most countries around the world. And I think this is exactly what the founding fathers wanted in a new country, is this kind of public speaking on behalf or against what's going on in government.
All right. Thank you much. John Hunter is publisher of the Madison Daily Leader, and Seth Tupper is enterprise reporter for the Rapid City Journal. Thanks for your time today, guys.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Welcome back to In the Moment. Lori Walsh is out today. I'm Kara Hetland.
I'm Keely Voltina. As educators incorporate best practices, bring new projects to certain subjects, and utilize innovative techniques in their lessons, one constant remains. You can't teach students who don't attend.
Truancy is an evolving issue in South Dakota schools. Local lawmakers are working to pass legislation to change state law regarding penalties for being out of school, and school leaders are using every tool they can find to convince kids to stay in class.
A snapshot from schools offers a glimpse into the major themes that challenge consistent attendance and what educators are doing about it. We begin with Terry Nebelsick, who is the superintendent of the Huron School District.
Any of the frailties in society you can find as frailties in the public school, because we're a reflection of the society that we serve. And so, therefore, whether it's the dysfunction of truancy or whether it has to do with poverty or children feeling loved or welcomed, there's a direct connection with their background, how their parents felt about school or how their parents felt about society and how they grew up. And the way that you change that is to try to break down those barriers and have kids feel cared about and driven and challenged.
Nebelsick says those issues show up in multiple forms, including truancy, a problem where students don't show up. More than half of Huron School District students are minorities, and its schools are becoming more diverse. Nebelsick says parents decide whether being in class is a priority.
Most of our families that come from all over the world are very, very faithful at attending, very faithful. They see school as the opportunity to learn English. Kids can come from all over the world, but they know that English is a language of work and prosperity and culture and pop culture, all of those things. So there is a huge drive in our citizens from across the world to be in school.
Nebelsick says Huron has about 700 high school students, and 20 of them are rarely at school. He says part of the problem started years ago.
Parents must make it a priority when they're K-6, so that students will make it a priority when they're in high school.
A 5 or 6 year old, they're going to do a little more as mom and dad says. They may have a little anger in some of that, but they're going to do more. So where you get to a 17, 18 year old, that they feel that they have some freedoms that that younger child does not.
Sioux Falls School District Assistant Superintendent Jamie Nold says those include a car or the ability to decide how to spend time when parents are at work. The latest numbers show more than 3,600 students in Sioux Falls don't meet the district's goal of attending school 94% of the time.
When you look at privilege per se or a higher economic status, those parents know the value of education and know that education has helped them to be in the position they are or to be in the job that they currently are holding. Without education, they wouldn't be able to have that job more than likely. So because of that, the parent influence, the family influence on you need to go and get your education, you need to take that part seriously, does have a very positive impact. Parents are very and vitally important in this whole process.
Yet Nold says he sees some parents and their students struggle. He says parents in low-income households often work many hours, so they don't or can't help kids practice their skills or foster a love of learning at home.
What are you doing to positively reinforce that attendance is good, or, you know, helping to break down those barriers where kids wouldn't want to show up because it's embarrassing, or they couldn't get their work done because home life is bad, or you know, the car broke down again? How do you fight that?
Yeah. Quite a few of the schools are doing a positive message on that as well. We would do drawings every week where we draw of kids that had perfect attendance for that week, and we'd do drawings out of there and announce them on the intercom with the students. They'd come down and get gift cards, and our community would help to give those because that was all donated money from booster clubs or community members.
Some people don't think schools should bribe students to show up, but Nold says educators provide rewards or accolades like business leaders do for employees. He says people respond well to positive initiatives. Still, Nold says those advantages are not enough.
If we have to, in the legal sense, we use the processes that are afforded us with the citation process, issuing tickets. If they're not in school, much like you would get a traffic ticket, you can get a citation for truancy. And eventually that could lead into probationary status or things like that.
The best thing about the citations is that that gives the courts and the judges the knowledge that there have been several interventions, including citations, that have been offered before it gets into the court system. The reality is, though, that until parents and other adults grab a hold of that we have to make attendance a huge priority, we're going to struggle if we're not going to incarcerate students. And most of us don't like the idea of students being incarcerated. We just wish there was a way to get them to school.
Huron Superintendent Terry Nebelsick says no one action can solve South Dakota's truancy problem.
Sometimes we try to have, we try to search for simple answers to complex questions, okay? Humanity is complex, whether it's drugs and alcohol or physical health or mental health or some disease that they're fighting or family background or genetics or location or children that have come from refugee camps and watched their brothers and sisters or their parents be killed, or children who have ridden on the top of a train while their parents desperately tried to save their life from oppression in Guatemala. There are no simple answers to the complexity of taking the next generation of children and getting them safely to adulthood, well prepared to contribute.
And Kara, both school leaders agree that it takes work from everyone in a community to keep kids in school so that they can learn and gain the skills that support them through the rest of their lives.
And so what other tools can schools use to get kids in class? And are they trying to get creative?
Yes. Administrators say they want to foster welcoming environments so kids feel like they fit in. That one seems, you know, fairly obvious. Administrators also want to emphasize options like breakfast and lunch so that they can satisfy students' appetites and then simultaneously their attendance. In Sioux Falls, they also utilize programs that help kids who are homeless or in transition get to school by sending taxis to pick them up and bring them to class where they know friends and trust the teachers who create those stable environments.
Wilson Caballo graduated from the Sioux Falls School District at age 13, he was a refugee who came to the United States from Africa, and Wilson made the decision to commit to attending school every day, and he joins us now in the studios at the University of Sioux Falls. Wilson, thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much. I'm very, very glad to be here.
Okay, so you graduated from which high school in Sioux Falls?
Washington High School.
Washington High School, and you decided at age 14 that you were going to go to school each and every day, no matter what.
Yes, I decided attendance was very, very important because at one point from this event that happened at Lincoln High School, they recognized students who've done well academically, leadership, and most of them, I did not know them. I've never seen them, and I'm like, do they go here? And that's because I was kind of disconnected with the school system. I was just going there because, you know, primarily friends, lunch, you know, all those things. But at that point, when I saw other students getting something because they worked hard for that thing, like awards, it really spoke to me. And I told myself, I want to be like that. You know, I think that's where the enlightenment came from. I feel like someone somehow has to have that little thing that inspires them to do that.
Because how easy would it have been for you to just stay home?
I have a strict parents, so my parents,
so not really that easy.
Not really. My parents will push me to go to school, mm-hmm. but at the same time, you know, just being there, I was not paying attention, and I would skip classes, and I just did not like school.
Oh, so you showed up, but you weren't always there.
Yeah, I showed up
there.
Just physically to be there because it was required, and that's what I usually say, you know, because most of us are required to go to school. Like for me. You know, with my age, you have to be in school. I can't drop out. And I have strict parents who require me to go to school because they have that concept that education is very important. But I did not see it that way because I didn't have another, you know, a strong why education is important. Nobody ever told me that.
So how did it change you?
It was through that event on a festival activity that took place at Lincoln High School. This event is like graduation. I mean, it happens at the end of it every year. Mm-hmm. And then they call out schools. They call out every student. And then they required to go to the whole gym. And then mm-hmm. we fill out the whole gym. Mm-hmm. And they begin, you know, it's supposed to be fun. And they're calling students, you know, it's supposed to recognize students who've done well academically, leadership. Mm-hmm. They even announced a student who never skipped a class in 4 years. And I'm like, how did they do it? It's kind of amazing. So for me, when they're recognizing these students, it really touched me.
Okay, so you were just a freshman when you had this. So you're end of your freshman year, you'd skip some classes, and all of a sudden, here's this award ceremony.
Yes.
And some of the kids get to sit on the floor, and some of the kids have to sit up in the bleachers.
Yes. I mean, right. I'm sitting in the freshman section, and mm-hmm. here is they recognizing students, and each one, we're supposed to clap our hands. It's just like graduation. Mm-hmm. You know, it's another form of graduation with our parents. And it's just all of us there. And then they're recognizing these students like one by one, and they're clapping our hands. I'm clapping my hands too because I'm supposed to do what others are doing. But it did not mean anything to me because I was like, I don't know anybody here. Like I'm clapping for people that I don't know. And you know, out of 50 times doing that, mm-hmm. it eventually got to me like, hey, like that's when it was like enlightenment. Something mm-hmm. hit me in my brain like if you – I became awake.
So what happened to your grades after that?
After that, I decided, like, it doesn't matter what it is. I'm going to go to class, and I'm going to change, you know, the rest of my life and make it the best of my life. That's the decision I decided, and that's the decision I made right there in those seats. Then when I went back after that event, the reality kicked in, like, of skipping class, you know, temptations to do all that stuff. But I believe when you have a stronger why you want to do something, you know, I believe when students are given more reasons to attend school other than their age or what the government law says, I truly believe you will win their hearts and minds committed to giving their all.
So you're 22 now.
I'm 22 years old, and I recently graduated college, and I recently came back here after graduation to do something in the community in
okay.
Sioux Falls.
Where did you go to college?
Well, first I went to St. Mary's University. Then I mm-hmm. transferred to Metro State in St. Paul, Minnesota. So I was living there. And then after graduation, I thought, let me go back to my hometown where I can do something. I can talk about this matter of like attendance, you know, because attendance really took me far. It did more than I expected because it is that little discipline of like making myself to go to school without depending on my parents, you know, attending school and say, hey, I want to attend class today. Cause I believe attendance is like 50% of the work. That little discipline really continuously helps me today because I have to, you know, just like work, I have to attend my goals. Like I have to get there. I have to wake up in the morning and do my work.
What's your goal right now?
Well, I'm doing my MBA here at the University of Sioux Falls, and my goal is to build a business. My goal is to I'm a businessman. So I do inspirational speaking full time. So my goal is to keep doing that and also build a platform where I can teach classes in terms of a character building and goal settings and all those things that we need in our lives.
So your message is it for what kind of a student?
My message is for any student who is lacking that kind of sense of belonging, like that kind of sense of like why they should go to school. Because we have so many students who want to be successful, but they don't know how, and the parents are not really giving it to them, like, this is why you need to go to school. It's almost like a continuous effort of like, oh, we go to school. It's almost like a custom. But I believe like my students or people, my audience, are those students who want to do something, want to go to school for more than just going to school. They want to go to school for something bigger than themselves.
And did you, when you graduated, did you receive numerous awards, get really good grades?
Yeah, that's a...
what did it... Being there and being present is one thing, but
yes.
Doing really... I mean, you said earlier you did really well in math, but you didn't do well in English starting out. So then how did you improve and your grades improve?
So when I started to attend school, I updated the theory of like studying, the habits of studying, because I think that's what you do. When you attend school, you learn more than somebody who did not. So how my grades came to improve was through going to class, asking questions to teachers, and then doing the homework. And within like 1 year, I received a student of the month award. Mm-hmm. You know, like I'm just disciplined. Mm-hmm. I attend school, no skipping classes. I behave right. And I think those fundamental things, I think that's school itself. I think that's what we need to learn firsthand to master the small stuff. Because it is there when I achieved that Student of the Month award, when I was like, okay, there has to be more. And then I kept pursuing my dream, kept doing better, because every student wants to do better. Like every student wants to ace a class. Mm-hmm. Like we might not act like I didn't act like it when I wasn't, but I think nobody wants to be miserable. Like nobody woke up this morning, you know, it's beautiful weather outside. Nobody woke up and said, I just cannot wait to be miserable. nobody did that. It's the same thing for the students. Like I don't think students who be misbehaving in a classroom or those students who do not believe that they're smart, I don't think they want to be represented by that. I think that's just those things that are like circumstances or accidental. But then because the society or other students or other friends label them to be that, they just adopt it. So for me, when I received that award, that student award of the month, that showed me that I can do more. So I went on to do more. I went on to do more homework. I went on to learning how to say no to students who wanted to hang out on a Friday. And I had to say no and say, hey, I have homework to do. But I think before you get there, attendance, it's the whole foundation. I think that's one of the reasons Dr. Maher believes in attendance, because one of the reasons I'm here today, or I was able to go to college, I'm able to maintain my business, I'm able to go to do my MBA within 8 years of arriving in America, and I was able to learn English so fast. I think all that stuff is because that single foundation of attendance, like just being there, being present, you know, that really helped me out tremendously.
And how much did being a refugee play into your decisions?
A lot. And I think it's kind of tricky because being a refugee, especially, you know, some parts of the world or some parts of the countries, you know, you get people who do not act nice towards you because your status. And most people think refugees are stupid or dumb. And for me, I almost adapted to that. But at the same time, I was like, I got to prove them wrong.
I have to prove them wrong.
And I feel like that's the responsibility of any refugee or any student in general, to just prove their parents wrong or anybody.
Okay. Wilson, I want to thank you for taking time and sharing your story with us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Out today. I'm Kara Hetland.
And And I'm Keely Boltina. Welcome back to In the Moment. Haiti freed its slaves 2 centuries ago as part of an effort to create its own government and break away from Europe.
But the most treasured colony in Central America had challenges different from those encountered in the United States, and some of those are apparent today. Jason Daniels is an assistant professor of history at Black Hills State University. He explains why this uprising is remarkable.
The Haitian Revolution, is revolutionary, I guess, for a number of reasons. One, we see the first colonial representation in the Metropolitan Assembly. We see the first colonial society to abolish slavery, the first colonial society to abolish racial discrimination. And we'll find the second independent nation in the Western Hemisphere, just a couple years behind the United States. And so a slave revolt, which then transforms into a civil war, that then transforms into an international war, sees the emergence of an independent republic more than a decade later. And that evolution and that challenging of kind of the establishment has profound consequences all across what historians would call the Atlantic world, kind of trying to understand the colonial world in Europe in their interconnectedness.
How does this compare then to other colonial societies?
Well, Saint-Domingue, which is the western third of Hispaniola in the Caribbean, is probably the most important and certainly the most profitable colony in the entire colonial world, making more money for France than all of the North American colonies for England did in any one year. Saint-Domingue itself is producing about half of all the sugar and coffee consumed around the world at the time. There are around 8,000 or so plantations, all of which are generating about 2/5 of all of France's foreign trade. It had become known as the Pearl of the West Indies because it had become so profitable, but that kind of doesn't give the full picture, because all this profitability and all this growth is based upon the enslavement of nearly 500,000 people who toil on the island. In the years leading up to the revolution, nearly 30 to 40,000 enslaved peoples are arriving every single year to continue this machine of production.
I just want to touch on the slaves that you referenced. You said some were brought in. Were these people who originated in Haiti and then were enslaved there? Was it a majority that were shipped in? Is this a combination somehow?
Well, it's certainly a combination of both. There's of course, millions of people who move from Africa, forcibly are moved from Africa to the New World, all the way across the Americas, from North America through the Caribbean and South America. From the period from 1450 to 1850, nearly 12 million people leave the continent, at least moving westward across the Atlantic. Some 10 million make or survive what we'll call the Middle Passage. And then we have thousands, tens of thousands in the 1780s arriving on the shores of Saint-Domingue alone. There are certainly large contingents of people being born, or what we call Creole enslaved people being born on the island as well. And the leaders of the revolution come from all ranks of people who have arrived from Africa or people that were born in Saint-Domingue as well.
And in what year does the bubbling and the tension kind of break? What happens that sets up this sort of major change for this area?
Well, it's kind of useful to think about the revolution in three parts, because there's kind of three interrelated groups. We had the French Revolution kick off a couple years earlier, before 1791. And in the midst of that, there's the calling of the National Assembly, in which white planters from Saint-Domingue are calling for colonial representation, much like what happens in the American Revolution as well, looking for a voice in the process of legislation and taxation and things like that. But within that white society, people are divided. You know, groups we could call Grand Blanc and Petit Blanc, or big or small whites. And they're united by their racial solidarity, but they're certainly divided by their class lines. What's unique about Saint-Domingue is there's a large population of gens de couleur, or free people of color, nearly 30 or 40,000 free people of color. And this covers a broad spectrum of people, from recently freed enslaved peoples to multiple generations of people of color who had been born free, educated in France, owned plantations themselves. And for white society in Saint-Domingue, they posed a threat to their hegemony, because they were largely calling for representation and social equality as well. And that's to say nothing about the 500,000 enslaved peoples who are also fighting for freedom. And in the midst of this conversation between free people of color and the white planter class and representation in France and autonomy in San Domingue, a clandestine group of people organized a revolt that kicked off in August of 1791, in which thousands of people simultaneously rose up, destroyed the sugar plantations, set cane fields afire, and kind of laid siege to La Cap, which was the biggest city at the time, somewhere around the size of Boston in early 1791.
That's a really dramatic scene that you described, that setting fields on fire. I mean, that's part of this revolution, this major catastrophe.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. I mean, it's certainly people are rising up and trying to destroy all the implements that have kept them enslaved, and then they sack the city as well. And there's multiple renditions, artistic renditions of this that were circulated around Europe that caused great fear. But it's also important to remember that while this slave revolt is going on the northern third of the island, there are two other sections of the island, what we would call the western and the southern sections of the western third of Hispaniola, that continue to import enslaved peoples at the same time. And so it's a hard world to get into the mindset of, where this seems like a very localized event, which then changes dramatically as Spain invades from the east and from the Dominican Republic or Santo Domingo at the time, and the English try to take land on the southern sections from Jamaica. And in the midst of all of this, the colonial government ends up abolishing slavery in order to co-opt the enslaved peoples to fight an international war against foreign powers.
So they say, you are now free so that we can rise up together and kick these people out.
Essentially, they grant citizenship to enslaved peoples. They grant full racial equality in order to consolidate power over foreign invaders. And then once that's accomplished, what emerges is a civil war, largely between formerly enslaved peoples and a group led by the Gens de Couleurs. And then ultimately what happens is, when Napoleon consolidates power back in France, he sends his brother-in-law to try to reinstate slavery on the island. And this kicks off the War of Independence, I suppose. And so several years later, every white French planter has been purged from the island, and a formerly enslaved man, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, declares Haiti an independent nation on January 1st, 1804.
You're hearing from Dr. Jason Daniels, who's an assistant professor of history at Black Hill State University, talking about the Haitian Revolution. He is speaking on Thursday about it. I want to understand better then, what is the full effect after all of this chaos, after all of this war? What do we see emerge?
Well, I mean, it's a paradox, right? The Haitian Revolution, for those who are fighting against slavery, and there's a growing abolitionist campaign growing at this moment, is an example of what could be accomplished, a source of hope in a lot of ways. But for those who defended slavery, it becomes an illustration of the consequences of freedom. You know, France will fail to recognize or deliberately not recognize Haitian independence for nearly two decades. They'll place a large indemnity upon the island, which just last year, Haitian officials are still calling for reparations from the French government.
Last year, in 2016. Last year.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
All last year. Mm-hmm.
So, in essence, they're still struggling for that independence that they not only won, but also had to then pay for the privilege of getting foreign nations to approve of. In the United States, we're very slow to recognize Haitian independence as well, because it's a threat to a lot of people in the South, because remember, slavery is still a firmly entrenched institution for nearly 70 years, more than 70 years in the United States following the Haitian Revolution. So it becomes very problematic for the Haitian people. And through a series of internal conflicts, some political mismanagement, some devastating ecological policies within the island, the problems just continue to mount for the newly independent nation. It doesn't have the luxury of a vast availability of land and firmly defined political institutions that the United States would inherit early on in its nationhood.
Sure, because we're so familiar with the story of how the United States managed this, and it's very different. You try to draw some parallels, but there are just some things that don't apply to Haiti that applied to the United States.
Well, simply put, I mean, the people who are in political power in the United States before the end of the American War of Independence are the people that are in power after the War of American Independence. There's not a whole lot that changes. And again, with Haiti, the world has been fundamentally altered. We see the first and only successful slave revolt in the entire colonial period, maybe in the entire history of the world, really, that actually gains freedom and independence for not only the enslaved people, but an entire nation of people. And that abolition of slavery decades before that would come in America, and nearly 100 years before that would come in places like Brazil and Cuba, the ending of at least legalized racial discrimination as well, things are radically different. Now, that's not to say they don't face problems in the aftermath, but the world of Saint-Domingue in 1791 is one that is fundamentally different than that of Haiti in 1804.
And what are the ramifications of this in today's world?
Well, we can see, you know, the legacy of colonialism and African slavery throughout the Caribbean, and we can certainly see some of the problems that Haiti still faces today. It's not to say that Haiti's position, economic position in the Western Hemisphere is all due to what happens following the revolution, but there's certainly some effects that are long-lasting. And again, it was the political vacuum that came in, political leaders without recognition, or without them gaining recognition from foreign nations, that created a lot of some of the political and economic issues that still plague Haiti today.
What do you want people to take away from your discussion?
Well, I think we need to think about kind of the connection between all these things, the connection between American independence, the French Revolution. And for a long time, the Haitian Revolution was simply just ignored. But it becomes more and more clear as more scholarship emerges that it has deep, profound impacts all across the Atlantic world. It has deep, profound impacts, certainly for United States history, not only ideological, but economic and political history as well for the United States. So during the discussion, we need to just kind of think about those connections and see how closely related our ideas about equality, fraternity, brotherhood, those ramparts of the age of revolution were linked, but how also they weren't applicable to everyone. So socioeconomic status, in particular with the Haitian Revolution, race becomes the key distinctions about how those ideas of freedom and equality are dangerous in their application, at least for the majority of the planter class and white Europe and white United States.
Jason Daniels, Assistant Professor of History at Black Hills State University, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.